go keep a couple of these. If anybody walks in, you're sitting in the right spot, Derek. Is that the starting bell or the warning bell? Warning bell?
Okay.
Starting bell? All right, we'll go ahead and start. I want to start tonight looking at Zechariah chapter 3, just for a second. Zechariah 3, we're talking about the lampstands. Verse 4, Zechariah asked, "What are these, my Lord?" Then the angel that talked to me answered and said unto him, "Knowest thou not what these are?" And I said, "No, my Lord." Verse 14, and answered I and said unto him, "What are these two olive trees upon the right side of the candlestick and upon the left side?" And I answered the second time and said unto him, "What are these two olive branches which are beside the two golden spouts that empty the golden oil out of themselves?" And he answered me, "Knowest thou not what these are?" And I said, "No, my Lord." Trevor may have already invoked this privilege when he studied Zechariah. We look back at chapter 1, verse 9. Back in chapter 1, then said I, "O my Lord, what are these?" And the angel that talked to me said unto me, "I will show thee what these are." There are a few books in the Bible, and really only a few, I think, that you have to study with a great amount of humility because of the obscurity of some of the things said. And certainly Zechariah is one of those books. I take solace in the fact that here was the angel of the Lord speaking directly to Zechariah, and on a number of occasions he asked, "What are these?" The angel said, "Don't you know what this is?" And he said, "No, I don't know what this is." We don't have the angel to give us direct comment tonight on what these things are. What I do have, I've got some capable Bible students here to answer questions for you. So the closest we have to angels tonight is somebody sitting next to you that might have the inside of the answer. But seriously, you study this book with a great humility. There are some things here. Now, don't get nervous about that last comment or statement there. You study with a lot of humility because there are some things here that we don't know. Having said that, there's much we can understand about this book. We know that history is past. Is the judgment talking about the downfall of the city of Jerusalem? No, it's already in the past. So as you look at history, we are able to understand a little bit, in fact, probably a great deal about what the book is probably trying to tell us. We don't have to wonder, as Trevor already pointed out in his study, about the context of the book time-wise. Some books we struggle about when it was written. That poses some difficulty right up front. Not so with this book. This book was written 525 18 B.C. because we're told that by Ezra as we piece those dates together. And we know what was happening during that period of time. We know that Persia was in power. We know that the first captives have returned. They've been back around 16 years. They started the building. They laid the foundation. That work has subsided. There's been some difficulties. From the book of Haggai, we notice that here were God's people in captivity 70 years. You would think that would have brought them to repentance. You would think that would have caused them to seek Jehovah. That in and of itself didn't do it. You would then think that God keeping his promise to Jeremiah 29:10, that after 70 years he would bring them back. You would think to be so overjoyed after coming back, after God keeping that promise. Once again, be reminded that God is faithful. That surely if they came back, were brought back out of captivity, then they would be faithful. But the book of Haggai tells, no, that's not so. Haggai starts with a pretty strong rebuke in chapter 1, doesn't he? He said, "What is the time for you to live in your sealed houses?" We learn from that short book, they came back, became very, very complacent in the very purpose for which they came back. Then you couple some of the words of Zechariah, but especially you fast forward just a few years to the prophet Malachi. How complimentary was the prophet Malachi to the Jews? One of the most scathing rebukes you could find, especially with their worship, how they viewed God, how they viewed themselves. So in this very, very short period of time, any devotion they had when they came out of captivity after 70 years, back into Canaan, quickly disappeared. So by the days of Malachi, we know from Malachi's rebuke, loyalty to God was almost non-existent once again. Now, those are some things we know. We don't have to guess because we have the writings of other prophets that verify all that I just said for us. Other things we know. We know also that after the reign of Persia came Greece. We've already looked at that. After that, there were no more world powers up to the time of Rome. We also know there was not another period that we know of where they were really taken into captivity. That is, the Jews taken into captivity. We know they were subservient to other people during this period of time. We know when he came back, there wasn't a king like there was before. Jeconiah, a great-grandson, for example, didn't pick up the rule when he came back out of captivity. That didn't happen. Instead, there was a governor placed over him. So, as we look at Zechariah, we sort of keep all of these things in mind, and it does help us understand, as we look at the context, what's happening and what has happened, the nature of the people. It helps us understand why the prophet is saying some things that he does. And as we look at the events that we know of, because we live this side of the fulfillment of many prophecies, that gives us more insight into what Zechariah may have been talking about in some of these passages. Without a doubt, no doubt you looked at this in your first part of the study, and with many prophecies there are oftentimes dual meanings. I think it's altogether possible and probable that at times Zechariah was looking at the immediate future, that is, rebuilding the temple, encouragement of God's people, the assurance that God would be with his people and would give them the aid and comfort they needed to be successful. But there are some passages we just can't overlook to where it tells this book is not restricted to that period of time. It's looking forward to the time of Christ. So there's a very strong messianic message in the book of Zechariah. Now, the challenge at times is sort of dissecting the book, parts of it. Which part is talking about the rebuilding of the temple? And which part of it really looking forward to the time of Christ and building that temple of which you or I are a part? So those are some of the challenges, some of the knowns about the book. So we keep those things in mind. Tonight, we're going to take a very brief-looking historical study. Trevor did a very excellent job of that in his last couple studies. We'll look at chapter 9 through 14. I say 9, I'm going to review it very, very briefly. It ties in chapter 10. At the very end, I put together a very simple sort of messianic summary out of the book. I got the ones that are least obscure. A careful Bible student does not want to speculate or over-speculate which ones. There are others that we could include. But this is a pretty safe list of messianic prophecies out of the book. Here is the kingdom of Persia we've looked at. Darius the One, or Darius the Great, is now ruling. In return, 536, the rebuilding of the temple began, discontinued during the reign of Cambyses, 529-522, during that reign, until the second reign of Darius. We know that from what's said in Ezra chapter 5. But we go to Ezra, and we pinpoint the time of this writing, because Zechariah is mentioned as being a companion, a co-worker of his in that book. Tad and I questioned rebuilding the temple. He said, hey, what are you doing? Are you going to defy Persia? He stands for clarification. Should they be doing this? Darius does the right thing. He makes the search. The search is, yea, verily, we found it in the records of Cyrus. And so he then directed that not only the rebuilding be allowed to continue, but also directed support for the rebuilding, even as Cyrus did in the very beginning. And then the temple was completed in year 516, or in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So that's sort of the historical setting for what we're talking about here in the book of Zechariah. chapters 1 through 9. Here we have the beginning of the first six chapters, the visions. Very interesting visions. These are not altogether difficult to understand, but no doubt, as Trevor explained them well, there are some questions arising about these. But there are some great messages that are easy to glean out of these visions. Vision of horsemen, God's knowledge and care of his people. True then, true yet today. The four horsemen, four blacksmiths. God's judgment upon the hordes or the rulers, or the kings of men who may have oppressed his people. as they're broken in part by the blacksmiths. The measuring line signaling the great expanse of Jerusalem. Here would be governed and be protected by the Spirit of God. Would not need walls. Very possible this messianic passage right here because of the expanse of Jerusalem. The people coming back would have had plenty of room in the city, one would be assured of, but not so with the new kingdom. The cleansing of Joshua, the passing of an order signifying the coming of the Messiah. The candlestick is an assurance, seemingly to Zerubbabel, that God would be with him and he would complete the building of the temple. The flying scroll and the vision of the basket coupled together, God's judgment upon evildoers, maybe directly aimed at the people of that period of time. As they came back, the work had languished. You look at the writings of Haggai, you look at the writings of Malachi, there were difficulties with the people during that period of time with their worship, with their morals. So here, God is going to do some cleansing. Also, altogether possible that is messianic, looking forward to the time of Christ. That in the new kingdom, in the new Jerusalem, that wickedness is going to be taken out. It's not going to be allowed in the kingdom. Vision of chariots signifying God's influence and control among the nations. So you move through the first six chapters, also in chapter 6, the introduction of Jesus as a branch. We'll look at that again tonight, along with Isaiah, Jeremiah. Chapter 7, question the fasting they had done during the 70 years. Was it for you? Was it for me? And God tells them, it wasn't for me, it was for you. You were filled with self-pity. That's why you kept the feast associated with the destruction of Jerusalem and you're being carried into captivity. Then we come into a chapter where there's encouragement from God that he would be with them as they rebuilt the walls. Rebuilt the temple. Judgment upon the nations, represented by Tyre, Sidon, cities of Philistia. A common theme with Amos and many other of the Old Testament prophets. Finally, we see Christ coming in chapter 9, coming in humility, his birth, or riding upon a donkey, as we see also in the New Testament, and also as a conqueror of all enemies with his death and his resurrection. So there, a quick review of the first 9 chapters that you've looked at thus far. We come into chapter 10. I picked out some of the key verses from each chapter, as we normally do. Also trying to understand in the first chapter at the top what the essence may be or the key message that we might take away from some of these chapters. You ever come to chapter 10, the first 3 verses, it's encouragement to rely upon God. If you need rain, if you need showers of blessings, you need to be looking to God as a provider of all these things. And you see that beginning in verse 1 of chapter 10, ask ye of Jehovah rain in the time of the latter rain. So right before the time of harvest and spring, he said, if you want rain, you better be asking God. Once you're in the past, and perhaps even at this point in time, they were relying upon the cherubim, the idols, the diviners, the false dreamers. They were relying upon the wrong ones. Certainly consistent with the history of Israel almost from the very beginning. You go back to Dan, Bethel, and you continue down the page of history. This was their history and may still continue to be it to some extent. And we see the anger of God is against these shepherds, these diviners, those who would give them incorrect interpretations of what they should be doing and what's actually happening. So we come into chapter 10, the first 3 verses. With God really encouraging them, as you look to me, as opposed to the idols and others. An interesting use of some terms here, verses 5 through 7, of Judah and Ephraim. Now, who was a person Ephraim? Who was Ephraim? Who was his father? Joseph. What was his brother's name? Manasseh. All right. All right, so here's Ephraim. We're familiar with that. As history continued, even as a coming into Canaan, the occupying of the land, we had the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And Ephraim then became synonymous with which kingdom? With Israel or the northern kingdom. And that's how it's used here. So it's just interesting the prophet uses the name of Ephraim in this passage. You also hear the house of Joseph. You'll see that, all right? Representative Ephraim. Here we see Judah and Ephraim will be victorious. But embedded in this is they're going to be victorious because Jehovah is with them. Verse 6, I will strengthen the house of Judah and I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back. This appears to be a reference to bringing back from the captivity, but it's being done by the hand of God. There was no army that would bring them back. It's God who set this in motion. God, by which prophet, spoke about Cyrus? Which prophet spoke to Cyrus?
Isaiah.
All right, Isaiah 44. God had this pre-planned 150 years prior, and so it didn't take an army to bring them back. God raised up Cyrus as the one through whom he would allow them to come back, orchestrated by God. And so now he has brought them back. Again, a very key statement here. We may come back, we have time, and revisit some aspects of the premillennial doctrine, but these are very key passages for us to keep in mind. That God said, I will bring them back out of captivity. And at this point in history, what has happened past tense? What has now happened with both Israel and Judah? God said, I'll bring him back. What has he done? He's brought him back. Okay? That's what everybody wanted to say. All right? So now they brought back a very key point. God promised I'll bring him back. God has brought them back. Now all didn't come back, but the door was opened by Cyrus. Whoever wants to go, you can go. And so the passage here, there was some out of both Israel and Judah. So another key point right here. Now some will make the argument, well, Judah came back, the southern tribe, but Israel did not. So just a key point as you study premillennialism to keep that in mind. And you see that reference made here. Again, as you continue on to chapter 10, a very interesting thing in verse 10, I will hiss for them. We still that day, all right, it may be that simple. I will hiss or I'll call. Hey, come here. All right, come on back. And that's a message here. That's a simple message here in this particular passage. I will call for them. I will gather them. So here's a picture. I scattered them into Assyria. I scattered them into Babylon. But he said, now I'm calling them back. I'm calling them back through my shepherd Cyrus, he says. So God now has made the promise that I'm calling them back. I will sow them among the people. Be careful of that word. Normally a sowing is a negative thing. Here is they're going to be replenished, much like you sow the seed. So here is this continuation of the point in verse 8. I will bring them back. They shall remember me in far country. They shall live their children and shall return. So he mentions Egypt, he mentions Assyria. Then I'll bring them back to the land of Gilead and Lebanon. Pointed out just parts of the northern kingdom that really never were possessed when Joshua brought the people back. But these are really the lands that would have been part of the northern kingdom of Israel. So he's bringing them back to their land. Then the judgment, the pride of Assyria, be brought down, the scepter of Egypt. Why would Babylon not be mentioned here, perchance? Just a happenstance, right? What's happened to Assyria by this point in history? Are they still in power? Syria's gone. Babylon's gone. What about Egypt? Now Egypt overcome by Persia. It's just some countries that we're familiar with been used in all the texts. Those who oppress God's people have been brought into judgment. Chapter 11, Israel desolated. This could be, and many think, it points to the destruction of Jerusalem, AD 70. A couple passages here, difficult to say. If there were an angel here, I would ask a question. What does this mean? Is this talking about AD 70? It would be my question. And the angel would say, Jerry, don't you know that? And I would say, no, I don't know that. All right? Now, this is one of those two or three verses that one could really debate. And in your mind, is destruction AD 70 or not? Now, what happened in AD 70, Jimmy? Jerusalem was destroyed. How completely? Completely. We'll see that later in a quotation. Many think that because the statement here, the pride of Jordan is laid waste. Some interesting passages come into chapter 11. It is looking forward to coming time. If it's not that, there's some difficulty. If you look during the days of the Maccabees, Jerusalem was not really destroyed. They were oppressed. They were not allowed to keep the Sabbath. They were hindered in serving God. But really, they were not laid waste. In fact, that would have been detrimental to the governors of the age to do that. That's why many make the argument, just talk about that period of time. In chapter 11, you got the discussion of the good shepherd, the bad shepherd. Some refer to the allegory of the shepherds. Zechariah simply talks about the differences in the shepherd. It seems that God has directed Zechariah. He says, Zechariah said, you go feed the sheep of slaughter. Now, the flock of slaughter would be the people of Israel, the people of Judah. They're the ones who had been carried into captivity. Now, you draw upon your knowledge of all that's happened. When God brought the Babylonian people into Jerusalem, we looked in Ezekiel earlier in our study. Did God want to do that? Now, God wanted them to come to repentance as we studied that. But once they hardened their heart, God told the Babylonians, have no pity. Remember that? Have no pity when you go into the city. That was done. So you think about all that history. Even though they deserved what God gave them in punishment, they were still God's people. It's like when I grew up, I had a bunch of brothers. We would fight among ourselves, right? The other four are always causing trouble. But what happened if one of the neighborhood boys started to pick on one of my brothers? He had to pick on all five of us, right? So it's all right if you quarrel amongst yourself, but just don't let somebody outside come in and bother my family. I think about that with God. Here his people had abandoned him. He had no pity on them when he brought Babylon in, but still, they were still his people. And so here's the retribution of God upon those whose possessors slay them. The Assyrians were very cruel. The Babylonians were very cruel in how they dealt with all captives, not just those of Israel, but all captives of the land they took away. So now he says, for no more will I pity the inhabitants of a land. Again, here are the inhabitants of Babylon, of these other countries. They're going to be armed up against one another. And I think that's meaning here in verse 6. He said, so I fed the flock of slaughter, talking about Zechariah. I took him to two slaves, one called Beauty, which means favor or grace, the other called Bands, or Unity, and I fed the flock. So as Zechariah is doing what God had instructed him. There were those that had rejected God and seemingly were rejected by Zechariah, being a shepherd. Could have been a leader of the people. Could have been some of the diviners he mentioned just in a few verses previous to that. He could have been some of those who worshiped the teraphim. We're just not told here. But in some capacity they were leading, and they were loathed by Zechariah. Then said, I will not feed you that which dies, let it die. Now here's the goodness of God, the favor. Right? That's one of the staves, beauty or the favor of God. So here is being rejected, it seems, by the people. Here's God's grace, here's God's favor, and now it's presented as being rejected. So I took my staff, beauty, that is, I took God's grace, which is what that means, God's favor. I cut it asunder that I might break my covenant, which I've made with all the peoples. I continue to study this idea of a covenant. Very, very interesting here. That's one of the challenging things of this particular chapter. What is a covenant? He says, I cut that asunder, that is, the bond. Now, we know from the context, talking about the bond between Israel and Judah in particular. Up to this point, they have leaned on each other for guidance, support. They did sometimes, sometimes did not. They fought each other, but it was there. But here is really a casting off of God's grace by the people. Interesting statement in verse 11. It says, the poor of the flock were the ones that gave heed unto me. Interesting statement, just as you bring your mind forward into the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, latter part of the chapter, the wise and the mighty. They reject God. If they can't explain it, they reject it. So it's just an interesting point, I think, in that particular passage. So now they've cast God off. They've rejected God and rejected His favor. So it's exactly, well, tell me what you think I'm worth. Well, then they weighed out for hire 30 pieces of silver. And God says, cast it on the potter, the goodly price I was prized at them. Well, that's how they valued God's grace and favor, 30 pieces of silver. But if we relate this 30 pieces of silver to what person in the New Testament, Carla? To Judas, all right? So we make that connection, and we see that connection even as we come into the New Testament. And then he cut asunder his other staff of the bands. He broke that bond between Judah and Israel. Latter part of the chapter left an unfaithful shepherd. Almost as he said, if you don't want God, what does that remind you of? Samson, Eli, Samuel, the people, then the people said what? They said, give us a what, Rhonda? Give us a king. All right? Very similar here. They reject, and God said, Samuel, they didn't reject you. They did what? They rejected me. Now here's happening again. All right? Now, the question for you to figure out in your mind is, what period of time are we talking about? Is it messianic? We're talking again about this period of time right here. And that presents a challenge. He said, I will raise up a shepherd who will not visit those who are cut off, seek their good, etc. So here is a worthless shepherd who would not seek their good. The easiest message here is, God says, I was good to you, I gave you my grace, you rejected me, and now you find somebody else to lead you. Very similar back to them desiring a king. Now we come into chapters 12 through 14, chapters 9, 10, 11 being sort of linked together. The judgment of God upon the nations of Philistia, Phoenicia, also upon the unfaithful in Israel and Judah, Assyria, Egypt, God's judgment. A number of messianic passages even embedded in the first 9 chapters, we pointed out a few of those. Now, when you come to chapter 12 through 14, it appears to be messianic most of the time, because if one does not take that approach, there are statements made that one just, you cannot defend with the scriptures about the period of history and things that are happening. So here's the burden of the word of Jehovah, or the message concerning Israel. Now there's one clue. Thus far, we've seen the name of Ephraim, Joseph, Judah. Now all of a sudden you come to chapter 12, talks about Israel. When you come into the New Testament, how does God, how does the Holy Spirit by inspiration refer to the Jewish nation? As Judah? No, as Israel. Now, Paul speaks of Israel. I would to God they might be saved. All right. Romans 10:21, talk about Israel. Satan said, all day long I stretch forth my hand again saying disobedient people. Romans 10. Now, so Israel now is a name of Jude, and I think that's one of the good clues about what's happening. You can't miss verse 1. Thus saith Jehovah, not just anybody, not the unjust shepherd. Thus saith Jehovah, who stretched forth the heavens and laid the foundation of the earth and formed the spirit of man within him. God says, I am the one that is speaking. I'll make Jerusalem a cup of reeling. The expression used by a number of prophets. It's always meant the standpoint of judgment. As though you take a sip of this cup of God's wrath and you'll be sent reeling on your heels. That's how this expression is used throughout the prophets. So simply a messianic prophecy about the deliverance of Judah and Jerusalem, but now with the name of Israel. Those who oppose the kingdom are going to be burdened. They're not going to be successful. Now you think about what's happened, and you think about history. Is there a period of time between now and the coming into the Roman Empire when Israel as a nation is really oppressed again by a peoples? Now, internal. Antiochus, we'll talk about a little bit later. There's internal oppression now from the Seleucids, but not to nearly the extent that we've heard about with the Assyrians and the Babylonians, the Babylonians. Here's a prophecy, again, easiest to see in Christ. And that day will make the chief of Judah like a pan of fire among wood, and like a flaming torch among sheaves. They shall devour all the people round about, and the right hand on the left. And they in Jerusalem shall again dwell in their own place, even in Jerusalem. Talks about a glowing, prosperous Jerusalem. And that day shall Jehovah defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them that day shall be as David. The house of David shall be as God, as the angels before them. It shall come to pass that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. See, again, this points us to a messianic prophecy. Because we just don't see a point in the future when they got that all the nations, in fact, there's never a point in time when all the nations are against them. Now, Babylon was against them, Assyria was against them, but not when all the nations would have been against them. So these are some clues to us, I believe, that it's talking about a messianic prophecy. During this period of time, I will pour out upon the house of David, upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look unto me whom they have pierced. Now, perhaps one of the easiest messianic prophecies, because this is quoted in the New Testament. And Jesus, as he was pierced, as his side was pierced. The difficulty with this passage, there's mourning. Was there mourning when Jesus was crucified? On the part of the Jews? No. On the part of God's people, yes. So there was mourning during that on that period of time. The same thought continues. It's unfortunate that chapter 13 begins right here. You back up chapter 12. Here it talks about one who's going to be pierced. It goes right after that. You keep reading. That day, the same day. Expression used about three or four times in succession. Talk about the same day. And that day shall a fountain be opened in the house of David and inhabit Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. So here's a messianic prophecy looking forward to the time of Christ. His death is when that would take place. Hebrews 10 verse 4 said the blood of bulls and goats could not do what, Justin? Could not take away sin. Alright? I couldn't do it. There had to be another fountain opened up. And that was a fountain of the blood of Christ. That would come for sin and for uncleanness. Here in chapter 13, 7 through 9, the wiggle sword against my shepherd, against a man that is my fellow, said Jehovah of hosts, smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. Jesus refers this to himself more than one passage, one being Matthew 26:31, because he refers to himself and quotes this particular passage. In this case, it makes it easier, doesn't it? The easiest type of prophecy is Joel 2:28, because the day of Pentecost, Peter says what? What does he say, Angela? This is that which was spoken by the prophet Joel, right? That makes it easy. I wish all of them were that way, but they're not. But in this particular case, Jesus applies it to himself. Interesting passage here. A bit of speculation here with these verses. It's hard not to relate this because we're in the time of Christ. We're familiar with the passages. 1 Peter chapter 1, 1 Peter chapter 4 talks about God's people being tried by a fiery trial, being refined as gold. You've got the identical language in Peter's writings, you know, as you have here. Paul quotes almost from Isaiah verbatim. They were not my people, yet now they are my people. The context in that section of Romans is looking at the Jew and the Gentile coming together as one people, all the way through Romans chapter 11. So the context in these verses and this are very, very interesting to make a pretty strong link, it seems, between those particular passages. Coming into the last chapter, chapter 14, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem in battle. The city shall be taken, the house is rifled, the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth to captivity. The residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then Jehovah will go forth, fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. Now the question is, what's this day talking about? Some say it's the destruction of Jerusalem AD 70. One of the more plausible arguments could be. Except Josephus says this. Now, as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained none to be objects of fury, Caesar gave order that they should now demolish the entire city and the temple. He's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So Josephus said, no, it's really didn't what we see. It said, let there be a residue of people. That's really not what we see. Well, this could be an argument that said, no, this is not talking about AD 70. It's talking about those powers that will be poised against God's kingdom throughout the ages. You come into Romans 1, in the first century with the Romans, the book of Revelation, I think is very clear, at least in my mind. There was a great oppression in the first century. Rome did destroy Jerusalem. But at that point in time, it was Jerusalem, how do I word this correctly? Was Jerusalem the seat of God's people in AD 70? No, that's a hard question to ask. It's hard to say it was a center. Well, you could say that. The word went to law and the word went out from Jerusalem. Now, many apostles still there, but Jerusalem represented the Jewish economy. In AD 70, that was no longer representing God's people. God's people are now in the kingdom of Christ. And so there's been that demarcation took place in the day of Pentecost. Hebrews 12:28, therefore receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. So no matter who or what nations or what people or what forces come against the kingdom of God, that kingdom cannot and will not be shaken. So here is the assurance that God is going to be with His people throughout the ages. This is a very challenging passage as we come to the end of the chapter. It seems to be that all who are in this kingdom are going to worship God faithfully. There's not going to be uncleanness allowed in this kingdom. There's going to be the new law that Jeremiah talks about, Jeremiah 31, 31. That day to be bells upon horses, holy unto Jehovah. Unlike the desecration of the temple by the Jews. Whatever worship it was, it would be holy, it would be consecrated to God. Much different than the picture we saw coming down to the very end of the days of Jerusalem. All right, messianic prophecies that you see. There were two or three more I pointed out as we went through some of the chapters tonight that most likely are messianic. Some of those are not listed here. Zechariah 2:10, many nations would be joined to the Lord. Similar to Isaiah 2. Isaiah 2 says, all nations shall what? Flow into it. Talking about the kingdom of Christ. We see a similarity there of Isaiah chapter 2. Zechariah 3, and I'm bringing forward my servant, the branch. Now, the first time in the book that he's introduced as a branch. Not